On. Good evening, everybody. So nice to see you all. Smiling faces, little backgrounds, little baseball. It's good. This is a good way to usher in, hopefully, because we changed the clock this weekend. So that means good news. Good news. Spring's on its way. But I don't like to say what the season after that is, because that's usually my hardest one. So we're just going to focus on spring for now. We're not talking about the next one. But we are continuing. We're up to a great Mishnah tonight. I hope an hour will be enough. It is, wow, a lot in this one. We're up to Shammai. We spent a few weeks talking about Hillel and his sayings. So tonight, chapter one, Mishnah number 15, Shammai Omer. Shammai would say, Asei Toraschah Kva. Make your Torah study a permanent fixture. Something that is set. Number one. Number two, Emor Ma'at Va'aseh Harbeh. Say little, but do a lot. And finally, V'hevi Mikabel Es Kol Adam B'Sever Panim Yafos. And receive every person with a pleasant countenance. You can understand very simply that there is so much information that is being conveyed in this very brief Mishnah from Shammai. But tell me a little bit. Let's start this way. Let's start with the very beginning. His first sentence, make your Torah study a permanent fixture of your life. What is he talking about? Is he talking about time? Is he talking about situational? Like what do you mean make it a permanent fixture? It should be a you should have a coffee table book called the Torah. That's a permanent fixture in some people's home. It never moves. It gets dusted once a month, but it really doesn't do anyone any good. What does it mean to make it a permanent fixture? Go ahead, Anne.
I would just think maybe it means it's an integral part of oneself. It's something that you do like breathing.
Okay, so you're already taking it, I think, even to the next level, and we're going to do that in a moment. But how about something just very simple? And I love and I compliment you on this pretty regularly, all of you. There's a certain fixed time. This is off limits for anything else. Your Torah study has a fixed place. It's a permanent fixture. Wednesday nights, 8 to 9. That's our spot. Okay, 8 to 9:15. Well, let's call it that because, rabbis have a hard time telling time. But it's a permanent fixture. We're not budging from this. And they tell some really amazing stories about people who really took this seriously. I do try. I'm not great about it. Things do come up. And okay, I'm not as good as I could be. This is a Mishnah to remind me. But they tell stories about people who really took this seriously. And for example, they tell a story about a wonderful Torah scholar who, for a few hours a day, his wife would run the store, would run the business. And he had his fixed, whatever it was. He had a couple of hours to do Torah study. And it was the arrangement that went this way for years. And it was a great arrangement for the both of them. One morning, one day, there's a customer who walks into the shop and has a tremendous business proposal for her. And she says, I can't make this decision without discussing it with my husband. This is a big decision. It's a very big proposition. So she sends word to her husband who's studying, who's learning Torah at the time, and gets the message, and he doesn't interrupt. He keeps going. And she sends a second message. He looks, he says, I can't. And he continues studying. And after he finishes his hours of study, he goes and he apologizes to his wife. But he says the following. And they lost the deal, actually. They did lose the deal. But here's what he told her. He said, if God forbid I wasn't around, I was unreachable, I was out of the country, or God forbid I was incapacitated, there would be no way for me to give you my opinion, and you'd have to make this decision. How, when I am in my Torah fixed time period, it's as if everything else doesn't matter. I'm not here. That's the level of seriousness that he took it. This is my fixed time. You see, as a kid, I had this trouble because I went to school, I did my time, the warden finally let me out after a certain period of time, but it wasn't, I shouldn't be saying it, but it wasn't an enjoyable thing. It was, I did what I had to do. I didn't have, in Yiddish, they say a geschmack, a real, delicious. It was missing that in many, many classes. And it was like almost to the other degree of where, oh, it's a fixed time. I gotta go ahead. And from 9 to 10 or 9 to 11, we're doing Talmud. And from 11 to 12, the rabbi's giving his lecture. And from 11 to, it was just too fixed. There was no fluidity, there was no flexibility. And it's only later that I really understood why it's done that way. Because it's not something, forgive me, Jeff, it's not something, Torah is not meant to be sitting on the beach. Not that you shouldn't learn it while you're on the beach, but that's not the intention, is to go sit at the beach drinking a pina colada while you happen to be perusing it. And if you're busy, okay, so whatever, I'll do it another time. It's gotta be something that's set. This is a priority. That's the word I'm looking for. Say Torah Keva doesn't just only mean a fixed time. It definitely means that. And it's got to be a real extenuating circumstance not to do it. However, Anne's point, and I think it's very well taken, is that the Torah is a priority. It's something that is fixed into your life. And it doesn't mean only when you're studying. When you go to work, when you go to play, what is guiding your behaviors? What's giving you the proper medium by which you do that endeavor? The answer should still always be Torah. How is it best? What is the right way to handle this? People discuss with me, people come to me and they have questions in life and questions about family dynamics, and they share with me. And I say to them, why are you asking me? I'm not a therapist, I'm not a counselor. And invariably, I've come to understand that they're not asking for Tzvi Tachman's opinion. They, in their head, they have in their mind that Tzvi Tachman is sharing with them what the Torah perspective is. And that's what they want to know. That's Asei Torah Keva, where you're making the Torah as a fixture in your life. That's what's guiding you. And it continues in every avenue under all circumstances. It becomes primary. It's really an important idea. Now, obviously, yes, Susan.
I have another thought about it too that riffs on Anne's, but I could wait. I don't want to interrupt you right
Well,
now.
say it.
I think it's an, I think absolutely yes, and I think that from the Hebrew keva, the container. It's a container for it, that why it is important is that setting aside that time creates an opportunity. We show up and are saying, this relationship with you, Hashem, matters so much to me, and I will come here and study, and it's going to build our relationship. It's a relational aspect too.
That's a great point. In a different context, the word keva also means a fixed place.
Yes.
It's a place. For example, there's something, if like in shul, there's something called your makom kavua. This is my regular place. This is where I sit. You see, if you go to a ball game, right, or you go somewhere, so yeah, you like certain section. This seat, that seat, it's all basically the same. You'll have, okay, you like this one more, you like this one less. In shul, it shouldn't be a free-for-all of where, 1 week you're in the front, 1 week you're on the back, 1 week you're on the side. This is my place. I'll tell you, I wasn't thinking about it until just now. My father, Zichrono Livracha, after he passed away, one of the people in the shul, so he came to pay a condolence call, and he said, I want to tell you that the way your father davened, He stood like a sentry at his post. That's the way he described my father. And it was really a profound insight. My father, most of us, including myself, is that when I daven, I shuckle. That's a Yiddish word. I'm shaking. I move. I sway. That's the way it goes. And if I get really bored, I go this way, go right, left. But most of the time, it's this front and back, and you get into it. My father would stand there straight, focused, laser focused, literally like a sentry at his post, because that was his place. He saw himself not just I'm in shul. Imagine you're in God's close, cabinet. You're one of the close. What's the word I'm looking for? The innermost, his cabinet, right? His close advisors, right? There's a certain seat that you sit in. It's not whoever gets to those seats first. There's an order. The president sits here. The vice president sits there. The secretary of defense sits there. The secretary of this is where they sit. There's assigned seating. There should be in shul your assigned seat. Okay, a guest comes in and someone's sitting there. Okay, don't make a big deal of it. But you should have something fixed. And the truth is, it works that way with Torah study also. There should be a fixed place. If you have an option of studying in your house or studying in the Beit Midrash, you should go to the Beit Midrash. It's a fixed place where others are also learning. It just creates an avirah, it creates an atmosphere, an environment. That this is serious. It's not just a haphazard getting it, whatever. But the truth is, it goes even further because it requires consistency. Have you ever heard the word of someone who's very, very fastidious about his studies? He's called a matmid. Masmid, a matmid. Have you ever heard that term? Yeah, it's a term, the jokingly would say that when a father has a daughter that he wants to marry off, and assuming he's a wealthy guy, so he goes to the yeshiva and he calls over the Rosh Yeshiva and he calls over the dean and he says, "Who's the best masmid here? That's the one. I want that son-in-law. Who's the best masmid?" That's what he would say. Who's the best masmid? What does the word matmid mean? It comes from the word tamid. You know what the word tamid means? Anyone? We used to bring a daily offering in the temple. It was called the Karban Tamid, the Tamid offering. The word Tamid means
That light or
no,
the
that's Ner Tamid. That's where it comes from.
means
Ner is the
constant,
light.
constant.
Yeah, it means always. Tamid means always. It was called the Ner Tamid. It's called the eternal lamp because it's always on. It never gets turned off, the eternal lamp. That's why it's called the Ner Tamid. The Karban Tamid was always, it was a daily offering. But here's the kicker, ladies and gentlemen. It wasn't brought all day long. It was brought part of it in the morning and part of it in the evening. But it was every day without exception. Jeff talks about this in terms of he does the Daf Yomi. He does the daily daf of the Talmud. The greatest achievement is why is it so successful? Because it's tamid. It's always. How many days are you allowed to miss in a month, Jeff?
I rarely miss.
How many days are you technically allowed to miss?
Zero.
Zero. That's correct. You don't miss. Okay, things come up, you have to double up, fine. But the goal of it is tamid, always. Aseh Torascha Keva means that it becomes consistent and fixed on your calendar every day. There should not be a day that goes by that you don't, even if it's only 5 minutes before you go to bed. This has to be the routine. 5 minutes, 10 minutes when you get up in the morning. That's it. No ifs, ands, or buts. I woke up late. Tough luck. I'll be 5 minutes later. I'm not giving up my spot. You gotta be consistent. That's what he's teaching us here. A masmid is not just one who learns all day, but one who learns every day. Every day. Okay. But there's something more than that. Let's see if the English picked up on this. Let's look at those words again in the Mishnah. Okay. Let's Shammai would say, ready? I'm going to read the first part again. Make your Torah study a permanent fixture of your life. You know what I think is a critical word in English? In that little sentence? This word right here. Whoops. Your. Make your Torah study a permanent fixture. In Hebrew, Asei Toratcha. Make your. Why doesn't it just say Asei Torah Keva? Make Torah study, a fixed. What's meaning? Make your Torah study. There's a
Personal to
general
you.
rule.
It's personal to you.
Yes. Go ahead. Explain. Why is it personal to you? Isn't the whole Torah personal to you?
It's for the individual. It's personal to you that you have to make that your own. You have to take the Torah and make it your own.
Great. That's the key point. It has to become you. It has to become a part of you. And the truth is, for many people, they find their excitement in Torah with different types of study. For some people, they love Chumash. They love studying the text of the five books of Moses. It's like their thing. And there are other people, they love the analytics of the Talmud. And there are other people that prefer, this is their kind, not to the exclusion of everything else, but what really excites them is the more mystical aspects of it. And there are those that are very law-oriented. They wanted to study halacha and all the contemporary issues that come up in society. None of it is wrong. But what is it that floats your boat? What is it? That's what you have to find, because that's the truth of where you're going to get the most geschmack. That's where you're going to get the most satisfaction and enjoyment. Not like I had when I studied certain subjects when I was in school. I didn't enjoy it. Now, thank God, I've come to like it a little better. But it just didn't do it for me. And I wasn't excited. Shammai says, make your Torah study that permanent fixture. Let's keep going. You know what? What time is it? Okay, we're good. Let's talk about this word for a second, because this word keva, making it a permanent fixture, is a fascinating word. The numerical value of this word keva, kuf bet ayin, right here. See it? I highlighted it. Kuf bet ayin is 172. Just throw it out there for you. There are exactly, if I tell you that Torah should be keva, it wouldn't shock you then that the number of words in the Ten Commandments are 172. It's exactly the number. There's 172 words in the Ten Commandments, but it gets better. I want to read you a story in the Torah. You're familiar with it. Nothing shocking here. You're all familiar with it, but I'm going to ask you a very basic question. The story goes about Eliezer, the great loyal servant of Avraham, who's on his way to go find a wife for Yitzchak. And who does he find? Who does he ultimately find? None other than, come on, who does Yitzchak marry? It's not a trick question.
Rebecca.
Rebecca, Rivka, that's correct. So that chapter, which is a very long chapter, is known as the Parsha of Shidduchim, of marriage. Okay? I got to read you the storyline. Okay? Eliezer is traveling. And he decides he's going to come up with a test to know that she's the right girl. So what happens? Comes to the well. He says, "Can I have something to drink?" She sure enough gives him. She also gives to all of the camels. Listen to what the Torah writes here. In verse 22, here's what it says. It says, "The man was astonished at her reflecting silently to know whether Hashem had made his journey successful or not. And it was. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a golden nose ring, its weight was a beka, and two bracelets on her arms, 10 gold shekels was their weight. And he said, 'Whose daughter are you? Tell me, yada yada.' Really. He meets the girl. Fine. He's convinced that this is the right one. Doesn't know her genealogy yet. Wants to make sure she's from the right family. And he's giving her gifts. He's giving her jewelry, which in and of itself is surprising. But the Torah tells us what seems to be an absolutely unnecessary detail of exactly how much he gave. Two bracelets whose weight were X, X, Y, and Z. Read it again. The man took a golden nose ring. Its weight was a beka, which we'll have to see, and two bracelets on her arms. 10 gold shekels was their weight. Forgive me. Does that have any meaning today? What does that even mean? Growing up, you read it, you say, I'm sure these were very expensive. That's what you would walk away saying. You know, there's what do you call it? A little tag on the bracelets that say Tiffany's. Okay, it's probably from a good place, right? It's the best. It doesn't say Dollar General. Okay, it's not. It's the real deal. But who cares? He gives one ring whose weight is a beka, two bracelets, each of whom his weight is 10 shekels worth. Wow, folks, fasten your seatbelts. What's going on here is as follows. What is a beka? I have no idea, but I'll tell you how I spell it, how the Torah spells it. Bet, kuf, ayin. Beka. Interesting. Seems to be the same letters as keva. Kuf, bet, ayin. Its weight was a beka, and he gave one of those rings. And he gave two bracelets, each of which were 10. I told you 172 words in the Ten Commandments. How many tablets were there? Two stone tablets, right? That contained 10 commandments. There's a deep allusion to this story, and that is Eliezer was telling her. You have, I see clearly, one half of the equation, and that is your natural tendency to do chesed, to do kindness. I asked you for a drink, and you went above and beyond. You gave me, you gave the camels to drink. So clearly, you have the trait of chesed, of kindness. However, there's another part, and that is. There's got to be a commitment to the Torah. It's not just you're a good person, but are you going to commit yourself to the Torah, which is alluded to the fact that its weight was beka, the 172, which are the number of words in the Ten Commandments, that is comprised of two gold bracelets that have the weight of 10. All these numbers are all there to allude to this concept. Of the total details of the items and its weight is hinting to Eliezer is hint telling Rivka, although you may excel in the trait of chesed, the bein adam lachavero, the interpersonal relationships, it's not enough. You need the second half as well, and that there has to be that relationship between you and God. That's beautifully symbolized with the Ten Commandments. Two parts of one whole. Okay. This is part one about this. We'll leave it at this part. Okay. Let's go back to our Mishnah. Okay. Make Torah a fixed part of your life. Let's go to the next part. Emor ma'at va'aseh harbeh. Say little and do a lot. Oh, if only people would learn this lesson. We promise the world, we promise the sky, we promise everything. And what do we deliver? Sometimes garnished, zip, nothing. Shammai says, you don't get it. The whole point is don't promise the world. Don't make these commitments. Just commit to a little bit and do a lot. There's a much better way to do this. Who tells us, who's the best story that symbolizes this? Again, you all know the story. Abraham, Abraham early on, when the angels come to visit him. Remember that story? Of course, you know the story. What does he say to them? Anybody? I'll read it to you. He said, "My Lord, if I find favor in your eyes, please pass not away from your servant. Let some water be brought and wash your feet and recline beneath the tree. I will fetch a morsel of bread that you may sustain yourself. Then go on, inasmuch as you have passed your servant's way." What does he promise? He promises to revive them a little bit after a long journey, give them a chance to sit under the tree, and give them what to eat. A little morsel of bread. Fair. Just enough. Next verse. So Abraham hastened to the tent to Sarah and said, "Hurry, 3 seah of meal, fine flour, knead, let's make cake." Then Abraham ran to the cattle, took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the youth who hurried to prepare it. He took cream and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed these before them, stood over them beneath the tree, and they ate. He only offered them a little morsel of bread, and he brings them a 3-course meal. And mor ma'at, say a little, say harbe, but do a lot. Don't let it be that you just promise, promise, promise. I don't know. Maybe politicians should learn this. Just saying. This is how God works as well. God also, when he makes promises, if I know the next Yontif is Purim, but on the heels of that is that other one that we're not going to say its name, right? But we sit at the Seder and we tell over the story. And in the telling over of that story, we quote a verse. In the verse, it says that God promises Vigam es ha, this nation that does afflict you, Dan Anochi, I will judge them. Two words. That's it. Dan Anochi, I will judge them. Well, we know that in the end of the story, when God actually redeems us, the Torah uses 27 words to describe the different expressions of the redemption because God said, I'll take care of it. That's all he said. I will judge them. And he goes ahead and he brings all the plagues, splits the sea, does everything. But I only promised a little. That's how we have to learn to do this. Now, maybe you'll say, okay, I person thinks that all the mitzvos and all the things that I've done, you know what? I've done a lot in my life. Here's another explanation how to read this phrase. The first one means say a little and do a lot. Now I'm going to change it on you. Here's a different understanding. Emor, say to yourself, ma'at, I've only done a little. And therefore, aseh harbeh, I still have a lot more to do. We love to give ourselves a massive pat on the back and say, look at what I've done. Look at what I've accomplished. It's amazing. Amazing. Emor, say to yourself, ma'at, what I've done is only a little. There's so much more I could do, and there's so much more I should do. It's a scary thought, and I think we've shared this idea, that at the end of life, when we come before God, he's going to ask us, not why weren't you Moshe? Why weren't you Avraham? Why weren't you Sarah? He's not going to ask us those questions. You know what he's going to ask us? I know he's going to ask me, why weren't you Tzvi Tachman? And I'll be like, what are you talking about? I was Tzvi Tachman. He says, no, why were you not all that I had invested in you, all of the talents, all of your abilities, did you maximize it? What am I going to answer? Yeah, I did great. Who else can keep Zoom going 3 years after COVID? Nobody else can do that, right? Oh, come on. He's going to look at me and what? I'm going to make up some cockamamie answer? What's going to be the right answer? No, I failed. I didn't do everything I was supposed to. Imagine, God forbid, a person gets to Shemaim, he gets to heaven after 120 years, and God says, no, did you invent the cure for cancer? And you'd be like, what? What are you talking about? Weren't you a doctor? Yeah. Well, why did I didn't think I could do it. He says, what are you talking about? I gave you all the, what are you going to say? What are you going to say? No, you got the wrong guy. They tell a famous story about the Netziv. Naftali, his name was Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Can you guess where he was from?
Berlin.
Excellent. So the Netziv, that's the acronym, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, Netziv. The Netziv tells a story that when he was a youngster, he was not a very good student, really not good at all. And he was not growing in his Torah studies, and his parents tried everything. They tried positive reinforcement, they tried getting a tutor, they tried everything. It just wasn't working. And he tells the story. He tells the story years and years and years later that he's making a siyum. He completed a tractate or whatever, the whole Shas, I think. And so he was talking, and he said that I remember vividly as a child. My parents put me to bed, and I heard them talking. It's not like nowadays where we have, you go up to your room and there's three or four bedrooms upstairs, and the parents are downstairs in the kitchen, the living room, dining room. It's two rooms, the bedroom and the eating room. That's all they had back then. So he's sent to his room, but he hears his parents talking, and he hears his parents crying. They're crying. So it piqued his interest. So he tiptoes out of bed and he listens. And he hears his parents crying to each other and saying, what are we going to do with Naftali? What are we going to do with little Naftali? Everything we've tried, it's just not working. I guess he'll be okay, but we had great aspirations for him that he would become really great in Torah. He'll get a job, we'll make him a profession, and we'll teach him, but it pains me. It pains me. And the Netziv tells the story that he overheard, and he felt the pain that his parents were, and he barged in to his parents and he apologized for listening. And he says, I promise I'll be better. I promise, I promise. And he became the great Netziv. He himself says, imagine after 120 years, I'm going to come up to heaven, and God is going to say to me, where's the commentary that you were supposed to write on the Talmud? Where's the commentary that you were supposed to share with the world on insights into the Chumash? And they'd be like, what are you talking about? I'm just a shoemaker. I made shoes for a living. I was honest. I kept Shabbos. I did all the mitzvahs I could. But what are you talking? What would I have said? You got the wrong guy? Clearly, I would have been wrong because I wrote it. This is what he says. Emar, say to yourself, Ma'at. I've only done a little. Va'aseh harbeh. Now go do a lot more. Never rest on your laurels. Keep pushing. Keep pushing. Now, maybe this is the source as well of not promising the world. Maybe this is the concept of why we say b'li neder. We say, I'm not promising. I don't want to make a promise. Because you don't want to box yourself in. Because you know as well as I do that every time you verbalize and you say, I'm gonna do X, you are asking for trouble. You are asking for something to get in the way. Keep your mouth shut and just do it. Make up your mind. Don't tell anybody. Just do it. Don't say it. And if you're gonna say it, at least add the words, B'li neder. I'm not promising. I'll do the best, but I don't want to commit because the minute I commit, I'm asking for trouble. Okay. We got perfect. One more. The third sentence, the third stitch of this Mishnah. Shammai continues and he says the last thing. Receive every person with a pleasant countenance. Receive everyone with niceness, with a pleasantness. There's a concept. If the Torah describes that if you go ahead and you damage somebody, you harm somebody, so you're obligated to take care of various financial responsibilities. If you did something to them and they now are on, they can't work, so you have to pay. You have to cover the doctor bills and the medical bills, and you have all these things that you're obligated to take care of. Well, one of the things, right? There's four ways, different concepts of how you can damage someone. One is you do it yourself, or something in your possession, where your animal goes and gores somebody, or your animal eats the vegetables in the next guy's neighbor's garden, or There's something you go ahead and you dig, for example, you dig a pit, you dig a hole in the middle of a public area, and somebody falls and breaks a leg. I didn't do anything. I didn't touch him. No, says the Torah, a bor b'rishus harabim, a pit in public domain, and you dug it, that's on you. Somebody gets hurt, that's your responsibility. Somebody, a great sage, I believe it was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the leader of the Musar movement that we talk about every now and then, he said that a person's face is a rishus harabim. His heart, that's private domain. That's his own private domain. But his face, that's a public domain. And you have no right to put a pit in a public domain. What does that mean? He saw one of the students in yeshiva that he looked like he was having a rough day. Really, he looked the part. So he asked him. He said, why do you look so bad? Why do you look so sad? He said, no, I just got a lot going on. I don't want to talk about it. So the Rishol Salanter said to him and said, okay, I understand. I'm happy to help in any way that I can if you want to share with me, but you have no right to walk around with that depressed face on, look on your face. Because when you look that way, the next guy feels that way also. You can't do it. You have to put on a happy face. It doesn't mean you have to fake it, but you can't walk around looking bad. You can't look because you have to greet people properly. I grew up in New York. Well, I never grew up, but my formative years were in New York, and it bothered me. It bothered me tremendously. And it's not a knock against only New York, but I would walk to shul, I would go visit somebody, whatever it is, and on Shabbos, and I would pass somebody. My natural inclination was to say, Good Shabbos. Good Shabbos, good Shabbos. Nice to, and I have no idea who they are, a stranger. But I see a fellow Jew walking past, so you say, Good Shabbos. And more often than it should have been, I got no response. Got no response. And it bothers me to this day. If somebody is kind enough to say Good Shabbos to you, I don't care if you know him, I don't care if you're not. How do you not respond Good Shabbos in kind? There's a certain basic decency. And the truth of the matter is, I should take it even further. We should be initiating Good Shabbos or Good Morning. How about a simple Good Morning? You pass someone, you go out to get your coffee, you go to the supermarket, say Good Morning. Say good morning to the cashier. Say good. That's how you treat people. Oh, I don't know them. I'm busy. I have a million things. No. Bor b'shus harabim, pit in a public area. You have to be nice. You have to be able to put forth a nice countenance. Greet people properly. The truth is that it's not just a good idea, it's really an obligation. It really is. Listen to a pasuk. Jacob, on his deathbed, he calls together all of his children and he gives them each a bracha, gives them each a blessing, each one custom made, tailor made for that particular child. Okay, one in particular, I'm just going to focus on now for a moment, is Yehuda. Yehuda, Judah, he's given a great blessing, but the last sentence is amazing. It says, red-eyed from wine and white-toothed from milk. Meaning to say that Yehuda, who's going to be the king, he's got monarchy, he's got that royal blood, he's going to be living it in a certain way, living up a certain class. Let me see if he quotes it here. He doesn't quote it here. But the terminology is that he'll be red-eyed from wine. It's great preparation for Purim, right? You're going to be so filled with wine, your eyes will be bloodshot, and white-toothed from milk. See, even back then, the Torah already knew that calcium is good for your teeth. That's why milk is good for you, milk is good for your bones. The Torah knows all this already. So, fine, that's the simple understanding. However, the Talmud finds a deeper meaning, an alternative understanding, and it says it is better to whiten your teeth to a friend than to give him milk to drink. It is better to show somebody the whites of your teeth, i.e., smile than to offer them a drink of milk. That's what the Talmud says. Obviously, it needs explanation, but on a very simple, simple level, the Talmud is teaching us. Do you know how much a glass of milk is worth to somebody? It's a lot. It means a lot. But do you know how much a smile means? Even more. It's worth even more to smile to somebody else. It's really a critical piece. Returning the greeting, that's basic decency. This is saying you got to go further. To initiate a greeting, that's sunshine. That's giving someone the light of your smile. Ah, brightens a person's day. And we know of many, many stories like this. Share with you a couple of them. But we know that studies have been shown that an infant, a small infant, can already differentiate between a smile and a frown. They can already, even as an infant, they can differentiate. More muscles are needed to frown than it is to smile. Think about that. She smiled at a sorrowful stranger. The smile seemed to make him feel better. He remembered past kindnesses of a friend and wrote him a thank you letter. The friend was so pleased with the thank you that he left a large tip after lunch. The waitress, surprised by the size of the tip, bet the whole thing on a hunch. The next day, she picked up her winnings and gave part to a man on the street. The man on the street was grateful. For 2 days, he'd had nothing to eat. After he finished his dinner, he left for his small, dingy room. He didn't know at that moment that he might be facing his doom. On the way, he picked up a shivering puppy and took him home to get warm. The puppy was very grateful to be in out of the storm. That night, the house caught on fire. The puppy barked an alarm. He barked till he woke the whole household and saved everybody from harm. One of the boys that he rescued grew up to be president. All of this because of a simple smile that didn't cost a cent. Great poem. Great poem. The power of a smile. Shammai is telling us everybody deserves a smile. You're in a cruddy mood, doesn't change it. Sorry. We have to be able. Yes, I'm not suggesting that everybody is always in the best mood possible. There's lots of challenges in life. But why should someone else feel that pain just because you're in a rough spot? We have to be able to show a greeting properly. Share with you another story. There's two great stories there. Power of a smile. When a yeshiva in Muncie, New York was expanding and was having a hard time getting the necessary permits, the yeshiva principal turned to Reb Mechel, where I'll tell you about who he is in a second, for assistance to expedite matters. Reb Mechel Taub was a well-known contractor who was friendly with Paul O'Brien. Paul O'Brien was the chairman of the city department that dealt with building permits. Reb Mechel readily agreed and wasted no time, immediately arranged an appointment with the chairman. Upon entering the office, Paul greeted Reb Mechel with a warm hello and asked, "So Rabbi, what are you building today?" Reb Mechel got right to the point and he told him, "I'm not coming for myself today. I wanted to speak to you on behalf of a yeshiva." "A yeshiva? Sure. What do they need?" Paul replied with a smile on his face. With a nervous expression on his face, Reb Mechel started to explain how the yeshiva was having difficulty in obtaining the necessary permits to finish the construction. Paul looked at the building plans, and upon seeing that everything was in order, he signed the necessary permits to finish the construction. With a very surprised look on his face, Reb Mechel asked Paul, "I greatly appreciate your quick response, but you seem more than happy today to sign the permits. Any particular reason? Any reason why?" With a content smile, Paul explained himself. "You see, my mom, she lives in a convalescent home for the elderly not far from here. Usually, When I go to visit her, she's in a very nasty mood, never smiling, always depressed and angry. Last weekend, when I visited her, she was all smiles. And when I asked her what happened that today, she's in such a good mood, she replied, "A few days ago, when I went out to sit on the porch for my morning fresh air, a rabbi passed by and wished me good morning. Now I go out every morning at the same time so I can see him when he passes my porch. He makes my day by wishing me a good morning with a friendly smile. Mr. Taub, I'm telling you, this rabbi changed my mother's life. She's a totally different person now. So as soon as you mentioned yeshiva, I was ready to help. If your rabbis can make my mother happy with a friendly smile, then I'm ready to do all that I can to help Jewish schools and institutions to the best of my ability." I thought that's where the story ended. There's one more sentence. Later, Rav Mechel found out that the friendly rabbi was none other than Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, who passed away in 1981, 1982, was one of the absolute leading Torah scholars in the United States and had thousands and thousands of students. He wrote various books. I have some of them. Unbelievable. But a guy like that, he's in his own thoughts. He's got a million things to worry about. But he saw a person wished a happy good morning with a smile, something of that caliber. Rav Kamenetsky, Rav Yaakov understood the power of a warm smile and a good morning. And if you think that that's just an interesting story, this one is even better. Okay, maybe not better, but it's not more powerful. It definitely is. Rav Moshe Pinkus, sorry, Moshe Pinkus, not Rabbi. Moshe Pinkus was a prestigious lawyer in Germany in the 1930s. And once, he was on his way to head a civil prosecution case against a high-ranking Nazi official. He was doing a good job on the case, and there was even the possibility that he was going to win the lawsuit. However, if this was to happen, it would strike a heavy blow to the authority and power of the newly elected Nazi party. As he entered the door of the courthouse building, he greeted the doorman with his usual "Guten Morgen, Herr Schmidt." "A good morning," as they say, "good morning." "Good morning, Mr. Schmidt." However, unlike the other mornings, Herr Schmidt did not reply in his usual way. Instead, he grabbed Moshe's coat and he told him, "Don't go up to the courtroom today. They're waiting for you up there, and as soon as you enter, you'll be arrested and you may never see your family again." Moshe was stunned. He asked the doorman, "You're a German, I'm a Jew. Why are you saving my life?" "Herr Pinkus," he replied, "of all the many people who walk through this door each day, you're the only one who treats me like a person and greets me with a nice hello. All of the other people simply ignore me and treat me like a piece of furniture. How then can I let those people upstairs harm you?" Moshe quietly said, "May you be blessed," and he hurriedly left. He went home, packed his belongings, together with his family, he fled the country to safety. This story was heard by Moshe's own daughter. You do not understand. We fail to understand the power of a smile, of a greeting. We don't know what's going on in other people's lives. I just found out today. I just found out. A very, very, very dear friend of mine told me this morning that looks like he's getting divorced. Not okay, divorces happen, but I'm telling you, I know these families. I thought I did. You don't know what's going on in people's lives, you just don't. As much as you do, you don't. And it is our responsibility to just smile, give them a good morning. It could lift them up, it could really make a difference, not just in their day, but in their life. This, I believe, is the deeper meaning of what Shammai, not even deeper. This is what Shammai is telling us. Greet everybody with a favorable countenance. Give everybody a smile. The power is tremendous. Let me just look here if there's one other piece to this. Yes, one last piece. You recall way back when, the second Mishnah told us that the world stands on three pillars: the pillar of Torah, the pillar of Avodah, divine service, and the pillar of Gemilut Chasadim, kindness. Some commentaries want to suggest they do it throughout the whole chapter that we're in, but this one I see very, very obvious. And that is, these three statements of Shammai correspond to the three statements of Shimon, who told us about the three pillars. Where Shammai tells us, make Torah a fixed part of your life, obviously that corresponds to the pillar of Torah. Where he tells us, say a little but do a lot, that's about our service to God, our service to others. Don't talk so much, just do what you got to do. Don't say so much. Commit the world, it never happens. And finally, greet everybody favorably. Give everybody that countenance, that smile that fits beautifully with the idea of interpersonal relationships about kindness one for the other. So, in many ways, we didn't go through it, but almost every Mishnah in this chapter corresponds to these three ideals over and over, and it gets reinforced. These are three very practical life lessons that need to be incorporated for us to be able to move forward. We need to have our Torah study. We need to be committed in our service to God and to other people. All three relationships are there. I say this all the time, and I'll say it one last time, till next time. And that is, these three pillars are the three relationships we have in life. Gemilut Chasadim is your relationship with others. Interpersonal relationship, man to his fellow. Avodah, service, that's between man and God. That's your relationship with God. And Torah, you know what that relationship is? Between you and yourself. That's who it is. It's an insight into you, how you tick, what makes you run, and how you can function best. This is what Shammai is telling us, these three things. Questions, thoughts, ideas? Let me hear. I'm sure there's got to be a whole different understanding in the Dominican Republic. It's just like a whole, I don't know. Got something else.
Rabbi,
Yes, Candy.
it's not a question, but I just wanted to make a comment about when you were talking in the beginning about your seat, in the shul.
Yes.
When I was working, one day it was pouring down rain, and I got to work really early, and I parked my van and I had a whole bunch of stuff to carry in, so I carried it all in. About 10 minutes later, the secretary comes storming in into my office and she said, "Candy, I want you to know that you parked in my spot." And I said, "I did?" She said, "Yes." I said, I didn't know we had assigned spots." She said, "They're not assigned, but it's mine." And she said, "Like, when you go to church on Sunday and somebody is sitting in your seat, you can't concentrate, right?" I said, "No, but I think I get the point." And she said, "Just be sure that you never park in that spot again."
Wow.
And you
Wow.
know what? I didn't.
Wow.
Because if you upset the secretary,
Yeah.
nothing gets done in this
I hear
school.
that. I will say it's interesting. A few years back, I was on the board of my synagogue, and the shul that I daven in, I love it dearly. I really do. I think there's so many great qualities. But like every shul, there's always something. There's always something that irks you the wrong way, and it's just okay, that's the way it is. Nothing's ever perfect. We know that. There was there for it's an old-time German shul. I mean, the founders came from Germany and they founded this place 100 years ago. Like it's just like, but it's very proper, very German-like. And there were people that if a guest was in town or you had a guest and you had them sit near you, and God forbid they were sitting in that other person's seat. In Yiddish, they say, Verminish git. Oh my gosh. It would be one of those OMG moments. Just, And I brought it up at a board meeting, and I was, I don't know, disappointed, I guess, how certain people stood their ground and said, no, this is my seat. This is, and I felt that there needed to be a little bit more flexibility. Yes, that is your seat, and you are welcome to have it. Yeah, but are you standing on principle? Why? Because it's your seat? Herr Tuchman, das ist mein Platz. Mr. Tuchman, this is my seat. This is my place. Yes, we should have a design, an assigned seat. That is true. And I'm not against that. It should be. Because otherwise, you know, one day here, one day there, you have to have it. But there needs to be that other part, that interpersonal concept. Okay, this Shabbos, so you go one seat over. What's the bit? It's not the end of the world. You'll live.
Rabbi, and I'm sure that Marcia will tell you it when if you're working bingo, those bingo,
Oh, I know it. I worked bingo many years.
they
Oh,
have their
don't you?
seat,
Oh, yes. You are right,
and
Candy.
you had
Woo-wee.
better because they can't win if they're in a different seat.
I hear you. You, it's a great, they, you're right. I mean, I saw fights, real fights over people sitting in someone. Oh my gosh. That's a definite verminishget. Oh my gosh. That's one of, Robin.
Yeah, this is a comment. You probably saw me get up a couple times because I got very emotional. Still am, because it reminds me of my mom, a blessed memory. She, I mean, and so when I'm thinking, when you're talking about the kindness, it's even, it's like, it, not just a smile, it's like a chesed. You know, you're doing, these are strangers, these are people that you're reaching out to. And she would be like that wherever she went, you know, grocery shopping, doctor's offices, whatever. And she wouldn't just like say hi and give a smile. She would ask about their lives and find out when their kids' birthdays were, and give cards. And then my parents had a TV business, and she decided she would get these pink pens that would have the name of the business on it. And that was like her smile. Wherever the person was, they wouldn't ask. She would say, "I'm giving you this pen. You're gonna need this pen." She would give it to doctors in the hospital. She would give it to anybody who you would could use a pen. And you know, I try to exemplify that, but that's, you know,
Yeah,
it's a
there's
hard
no
quality that
question.
she had,
You're
you know.
reminding me again. It's another story. Randy, I'll get in one second. It's another similar story of where there was a factory. I don't, whatever. I think the story goes, if I remember correctly. And there was some issue, and they were closing for the day. And the guard said, "I don't think everybody's out yet." And they were like, "What are you talking about? Everybody left a while ago." He says, "No, I have a sneaky feeling that not everyone's out." Long story short, that one of the workers was actually got stuck in the fridge. Got stuck in the fridge in there. And they asked the guard, "How? What made you even think about this?" He says, "Because every single morning, this guy comes and he wishes me good morning, and when he leaves, he always says to me, 'Have a good night.' And I didn't remember him saying, 'Have a good night today.' He must have still be there." And he saved his life. That's how it is. It's this is, we call it common courtesy and common decency, but it's not common. It's really not. This is something that it's easy for us to do. It's not, it as this as that poem says, it doesn't cost a penny. It doesn't cost anything. Say good morning, say good afternoon, say hello. You get on an elevator. Most people, what do they do? Eyes go right down. You know, I don't wanna, don't make eye contact because then you gotta say something. Wrong. Say good afternoon. Hey, nice to see you. Yeah? Say something. Force yourself. I grew up as a kid. I did not have good social skills. I know it sounds funny, but it's true. I did not. And I had to force myself. I had to force myself to learn to look people in the eye and greet them. It did not come naturally to me. Now my wife wants to know when I where's the off button? So the way it goes. Randy.
There's a principle or thing that I'm reminded of when you want to do something, in order to make it a habit, you've got to essentially make an appointment with yourself to do whatever it is, whether it's read a book or exercise or daven or what have you. And so it's almost like making an appointment with yourself and Hashem. You're having a meeting with him to discuss whatever it is,
Yeah.
you know. But the other thing is, how many times do people go to daven and then forget everything that they just, you know, you gotta take action on it. And I think, you know, there's some of that in, you know, in what we were
Yeah.
saying tonight.
Yeah. There's no question it has to be turned. We're going to get to a Mishnah, God willing, later on. Lo ha-midrash ikar. It's not the studying that's primary. Ela ha-ma'aseh, the action. You're right. It's very nice. And I don't, we'll talk about it when we get there. But yeah,
You know,
we ask for things, we talk about things, and then we got to go do it.
it says to, you know, to carry a smile. Well, go do it. Go
Yeah.
practice it
Yeah.
until it becomes a habit.
That I'm living proof of it. I really am. That's what it is. So these are three things that we all can do. Fix time for study, be smart with how we make commitments with our words, say less than what we really are committing towards and just do more, and give people the smile. Those are three easy things that we can incorporate right away.
Real quick,
Yes.
just repeat the three pillars. This would be
Torah,
right.
Avodah is divine service, and Gemilut Chasadim, kindness. There's the interpersonal between man and his fellow, that's the kindness. There's man to God, which is the Avodah, the service. And then there's man with himself, right? That's Torah. Those are the three relationships in our lives. All right. Yes, Fred.
Years ago, we lived in Buffalo. Ellen asked me to go to the dry cleaner and pick up the clothes. And I walked in, I handed the ticket, and the person looked at me and said, "Oh," because Ellen's name was on it. "Your wife, that's the one that comes in here with a smile all the time. It's
There you
always
go.
smiling."
There you go.
And I never forgot that. But Ellen did.
It
She
made such an impression on somebody. It's really we undervalue the power of a smile. It's really such an amazing gift. I showed you in the Torah. This is the blessing that Jacob gave to Judah, that we learn from it, that power of a smile. All right. Held you hostage long enough. Keep smiling, folks. You got it. All
Thank
right.
you.
Next week, God willing, we're going to meet, but we're going to talk about Purim because it's right before Purim. So we'll do a special on Purim. All right.
Okay.
All right. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi T.
Thank
A
you. Thank you,
pleasure.
Rabbi.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.